So I don't see, we still have 3 more minutes. So Greg and I just like last week got back. We went to Germany for 2 weeks
Yeah, did you like
and
it?
yes, we had just an absolute blast. We had 6 days. We went to a Burning
Were you
Man
in Berlin?
event in outside of Berlin, which was a blast. And then after
How was
that,
the music?
I mean, I'm not always there for the music. Like, people like super loud, thumpy music. I just want to
Yeah.
talk to people. So
Yeah,
for
I hear
me, super loud, thumpy music is not necessarily my jam. I mean, I appreciate that all my
you.
friends like it, but
Yeah.
I'm like, that's too loud. I'm an
Right.
old lady. Turn it down. But the festival itself was great. We made some really lovely pe met lots of great people and had a really nice time. There was a one theme camp who brought five saunas like on wheels. Oh, it's Jackie. This is the person I just heard about. So every night we got in a different sauna. They had five saunas and a hot tub and a outdoor shower, which was really lovely. And then after these 6 days, hanging with our burner people in that space, then we decided to go tour Dachau. So we took a 3-hour tour of the concentration camp,
Yeah, I know what it is.
which is not my first tour of a concentration camp, but it's my first tour of a concentration camp since America started heading toward fascism. And
Yeah.
so that's that lady. We did a 3-hour tour at the concentration camp, and then the next day we did a 3-hour tour called the Third Reich in Munich. That was all about like, here's where, Hitler met this guy who pulled him into politics. And
Yeah.
here's where, Hitler and Chamberlain and so and so sat down and signed this peace accord that didn't turn into peace at all. And here's where he met with the brown shirt people. And
Yeah.
anyway, the combination, those 6 hours of people presenting about basically, the rise of Hitler and how it all happened was a really, it was a big change from 6 days, hanging out outside and playing in the sunshine with my friends.
Yeah, it's like two totally different universes.
And then after those two things in Munich, we drove north and we met with Stephen Whitsett of Facts Not Fear.
Yeah.
And he actually had let his medical license expire, so he didn't get to take Greg up in a plane, but he had friends that took Greg up in a plane in a glider, and they went up in the air and did like loop-de-loops and flippy flips, which was terrifying to watch. And then I got to connect with Steven and this other guy, Gus, both from his organization, and we tried to make a video. It's a beautiful setting, but like the audio files didn't end up working, so we're gonna have to retape it. But it was a really nice, well, I don't know about nice. Basically, he spent a good long time basically trying to convince me that we should say screw you, United States, and move to Germany because
I hear
America is getting crazy, crazy,
that. Definitely.
crazy. And right before I left, Trump signed this executive order to civilly commit homeless people and people on drugs and people with mental disabilities, undefined, like they have to flunk this test or pass this test, just anybody he decides could he declare mentally disabled. Which sounds a whole lot like what Hitler did when they first started. That first concentration camp, Dachau, was the first one. They did, it wasn't just for Jewish people, it was for political opponents. It was for re-educating political opponents. So, yeah, things were terrifying. Okay, let's see if our. Oh, Danelle is here. Hurrah. All right, let me unmute you, Danelle. And shall I also unmute Jackie? Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, you are all unmuted, Joey and Jackie and Danelle. So welcome everybody. Sorry for missing 2 weeks ago. And Beverly, thank you, thank you, thank you for, I haven't had a chance to like listen to the audio file, but thank you for running it. I heard it went well and people were happy to be there. I'm gonna unmute you. Hang on.
You're welcome. And I was glad to do it. And Chuck and I make a great team.
Yay! Excellent. All right, so here we are. Danelle and Joe and Jackie from Shine Voices and Wash are going to present to us about whatever they decide they want to present.
Well, I think that we're here to just kind of share a little bit of our more recent evolution in our advocacy for ourselves and for everybody. And first, everybody I think on this call is probably familiar with Joe, and you ought to be if you're not, because he's not your average Joe. That's a great line from our the DC Vigil United anyway. But you might not be familiar with Jackie. And I want to introduce you to Jackie. She's a Shine sister. So she is part of our Shine Voices group, a woman forced to register, and she's an amazing advocate. And I'm gonna let her talk to you a little bit about herself, because she's quite capable of telling you about herself. I just want you to know that I feel like she's a really an amazing person, and that I know Joe feels the same, because we're working together as a team, and we're really, really grateful and blessed to have her on the team. So you want to tell them a little bit about yourself, Jackie?
Sure, yeah, thank you. It's exciting to be here, and I would say, just in the last couple months, I've really just stepped into the light of advocacy that's, more forward facing. So everything has been moving sort of at lightning speed for me, which is pretty great. I have been on probation for the last 7 years in Florida. And I have just a really interesting background. I have a bachelor's in criminal justice, which is kind of ironic. I have a master's degree in theology, and my community service and my ministry really informed a lot of how I wanted to participate in this world and get involved. And I really saw things as pretty black and white back in the day. And simultaneously, I also was a sign language interpreter working in the school system, and frequently got asked to take over teaching ASL at the high school level, which is where my path sort of collided into pure misery when I got first emotionally involved with my 15-year-old student, who we had both experienced sexual trauma in our life ourselves, and she was sort of pushing me to find my sexuality, which I had been closeted for my whole life. And a beautiful storm occurred. And then, in one moment, everything changed. And suddenly, I found myself on the other side of the justice system, and the other side of faith, and the other side of community. Went deep into hiding, deep into healing, and then, weekly therapy for a good 5 years, and just set myself on a journey of self-discovery to really figure out, where do I go from here? I had been pursuing my PhD in intercultural studies. I had continued this through the early part of my probation. I completed that, but unfortunately, my online, it was a fully online program out of South Carolina. And unfortunately, after they passed me, they Googled me and then decided to withdraw me and expel me and take it away. So I really, at that time, I was really involved in academic publishing. I was looking into spirituality in the deaf community, just intersectionality, intercultural studies, and being able to continue my PhD at that time was pretty much the only thing I had left. And so that was pretty devastating. So I shut my brain down and just focused on healing. And then after a good 5 years or so, I happened to see our therapist saw a publication put out by Dr. Megan Mitchell on 25 years of a meta-analysis on SORMLaws. And our group decided to reach out to her and offer any insight that we could offer as people with lived experience. And so she had reached out, and we kind of formed a publication team. And we started last year, we started publishing on how to incorporate people with lived experiences, especially those convicted of sex offenses, and how to use that lived experience to shape policy, how to build teams, how to incorporate that. So from there, it just sort of led into me publishing my own book on resilience training, on mindset, shifting your mindset, and helping people to sort of recover and rebuild. And then that sort of led me to get connected with Joe and Danelle, and here I am. So
Wow, what's the name of the book?
it's called True Resilience. There's a bunch of other words, but that's the gist of it.
So she, Jackie, is on a board with me, and it was that and her book that brought her to my attention. And actually, Joe met her first, of course. And Joe
Good
said,
at that.
"You gotta talk to this Jackie girl. She is amazing. She's got it going on." And he recognized immediately that the work that she was doing with Megan, and her work that she did on herself and her book and her perspective was almost exactly aligned with the mission and the conversation and the evolution that I was doing with my Shine Voices group. We hadn't read her book yet, but we were having those conversations already. And so Joe's like, "You have to talk to her. You know, she's already completely in line with, how you all are thinking and your mission." And I think I've mentioned before when I've been on that, the Shine Voices mission, we have a lot of things that we are, but one of the things that we do, like when we speak, is we're talking a lot about changing the narrative. And I say it all the time because I want it to just burn into your brain. If it hasn't already and you're tired of hearing it, oh, make sure you are at some point, because it's one of the most important things we can do as persons forced to register and those who love persons forced to register if we want something to be different for us and our loved ones' lives. Everybody who's impacted, if you want something to be different about that, and most of us do, we have to change the narrative, because the narrative that exists right now that we have very little control over is very negative. We know that it's destructive. It's negative. It's also not true. It's false. And so it's upon us to bring the truth to change the narrative. So we've been talking about and thinking about different ways to make that happen. Because you can't just say, "Well, it ought to change." I mean, you can, but you're not going to get much out of that. And so, I like to go back to the foundation of what I think advocacy is. Always a start from there, because if we don't understand that, we don't even know what we're doing. So, what evolution of advocacy? What is advocacy? And so, it's like, for I always say, advocacy starts with yourself. And at first, you have to establish in your own mind. And I know this is a lot of Joe's message as well that he brings. You have to establish in your own mind your identity and your self-worth, that you have worth and what it is. Okay. And then you have to realize and totally embrace your true identity, which can be a sounds so like, "Oh, well, of course you should." Well, that sounds simple. It is most certainly not. And it's definitely not very easy for people who have been had a very negative, false, destructive identity smashed onto them. So the identity that we're given by the criminal legal system, the politicians, media, popular culture, which is that identity is from that narrative. This is what your narrative is, what you say. And they say we're this and we're that and we're this and we're none of those things. And we know that inside ourselves, but sometimes we don't. A lot of folks, unfortunately, who are in our community, whether they be a PFR or they're a supporter, loved one, or whatever, they believe this false narrative about themselves. And your ne things will never improve for you or the rest of the community, your family, if you keep on believing that. So I always tell people the very first thing you have to do if you want it to be different is you have to believe the truth about yourself, which is that you are worthy, that you have a real identity that has nothing to do with what happened to you. That is something that happened. It was an
That takes
incident.
so much time.
Yeah.
That takes so much time. You start out on this, like, the immediate aftermath is just guilt and shame and all of the unintended harm that was caused to just everybody, your family, your professional network. And to get, I remember when I was sentenced, feeling like, this one size fits all label and charge is like putting on an overcoat that is way too big for me. And yet, when you're dealing with such shame and guilt, you have a very low place to start climbing from. And so, my perspective now, I remember going to, well, attending the conference last year. I had to be virtual because I can't travel yet. And just hearing the difference of language, the person forced to register, and realizing how liberating that was, and realizing, now this evolution after really coming to terms with that kind of shame and guilt, and being able to say for yourself, I still deserve a good life. I still deserve to be happy. And other people could say that for me, but it took me a really long time to get to that point. And now I realize it's not that the label and the charge is too big for me. It's I'm too big for it. It's like I am 10,000 times the uplifter than I've ever been an offender. So it really just takes a lot of time and healing, but it is an evolution. And once you get on the other side of it, there's no telling, no stopping us.
No. So, Joe, tell me when did that epiphany happen to you? You remember? He's muted.
Oh, hang on, I will find him. Thought I unmuted him before,
It's
but I
coming.
guess
You
remute.
did.
Here
There
we
we go.
go.
Say that again, Danelle.
Well, so she's sharing. I had that same epiphany, and I remember exactly the moment it happened. But the epiphany where you realize, first you, I mean, most of us think we're the, excuse my French, piece of shit that they told us we were because we made a mistake. Okay, we made a mistake and it wasn't a good mistake, but we're not a piece of shit. But we're told that and we're feeling it and we're believing it and we're rolling in it. And for some people, it's a really long time, and for some people, it's not. But do you remember when you had the epiphany that you were not that was not who you are?
I never had to have that because I was born with a mentality. Like it was instilled in me in my household as a kid. So I was born with, you could call me whatever you want. That's not what I'm going to answer to. So I never had an epiphany. It's just, it was a realization that, okay, this is the label that I live under, but this is the label that I will destroy also. I won't live under the stigma of this. Eventually I will come out from under this. So I never really was like, damn, I'm a piece of shit, and then realized like, oh, I'm not a piece of shit. I never felt like a piece of shit. I felt like a piece of shit for what I did and what it did to my community and what it did to my mother and my father. But me personally, I
You
wasn't
do
born with
better.
that. I wasn't born with that. I was born with a different mentality. So that never happened with me.
Well, and that's beautiful, and that, and I would give those parents of yours some credit for some of that, because
Right.
somebody poured that into you. And I would say, just in general, and I'm making a huge sweeping generalization here, so I'm going to own that. that women tend to, we're already in the mode of beating ourselves up all the time, diminishing ourselves in our own minds. I've been working on sweeping the wicked narrative in my head out for years, and it was surely going full strength when this awful thing happened to me. And so it just lit fire on it. It was like I took a wicked narrative that was already going in my head, beating on myself. Not wicked in that I was thinking about doing bad things, wicked in that I was beating myself up all the time. I was never good enough. And then this thing happened to me, and it was like putting gasoline on that fire. And that was a conflagration for a long time until one day I realized, like, you knew all along, but that wasn't true. And I wish more people have your attitude, but unfortunately, even ones who had, knew who they were and have confidence in that somehow end up getting crushed so much they start to
Believe it. And that's not to say that I've
believe.
never battled with that part of it. That wouldn't be true to say that I've never really struggled with it, because I'm reminded of it every day from people in my family, people that, like, indirectly have things to say. I'm reminded every day, but internally, I have a knowing, an internal knowing that I am not a piece of shit, and no one is a piece of shit.
Right.
Like, everyone is
That's
of
huge.
supreme value. So
Amen.
if everybody is of supreme value, so am I. I'm going to start treating myself that way, you
And
know? So no, I'm not a
that's the
piece of shit.
beginning. Right, but
And
that's
most
the
people don't
beginning.
come from that. Most
No.
people, everybody, I think, struggles with a level of, for most, maybe it's not as extreme as self-hate, but I think a lot of people don't accept themselves and have a hard time. And, my mental battle was much like yours, Sanel, where I spent my whole life telling myself that I was a monster, that I didn't fit in, that I was an outcast, that something was different about me and I couldn't figure it out, all these things. And just you tell the world starts mirroring exactly what you think about yourself and exactly what you say about yourself, and it's an actual cycle that has to be broken for a lot of us, and it has so little to do with the actual event or situations that come up where we act on something. It has everything to do with mindset. So the fact that,
Yeah.
Joe, you started that way, that's huge. That's what we
It is
gotta teach
huge.
people.
That is exactly why he's so good at teaching
Yeah.
people.
That is my position with WASH. That's my position, is to instill the mindset. I don't have nothing else to do here. WASH is ran by women. I'm here to help a mindset. That is all. I'm this the role is reversed. The quarterback is now the cheerleader. The role is reversed. The girls are on the field, the guys are the cheerleaders here. And that's
Right
how I'm
on.
feeling about that. So I'm here to instill a mindset so everybody feels like they can run through a brick wall. And it's not a false
Amen.
thing. It's going to be a very authentic way of teaching people how to run through a brick wall. It's not going to be some rah-rah, sis, boom, bah, where it's real fake and cheesy. No, I'm going to
Well,
give everybody the confidence to basically be what they could be for this mission or a part of this body. We, like I always say, we need people from the mind, the heart, the toenail, the foot. We need every piece, but every piece has to be confident.
yeah.
Every piece
Yes.
has to believe that they're not a piece of shit, because if the mind's believing it's not a piece of shit, then the whole body has to believe it's not a piece of shit.
And there's a
Absolutely.
difference too between, completely separating yourself mentally in that mindset and accountability, because I still
Right.
believe that, accountability is very important.
Yes.
And I've had to learn how to navigate to reconcile the fact that, like, yes, I should have known better. Yes, I was the adult and the authority in the room. I recognize that I was not the one with the power in the room. I recognize now that, I could only do as well as I could do in that moment, but I can't say that, I'm above it all, because I'm not, and that's part of the evolution of it, is that there is still accountability, and there is still an acknowledgement that multiple things can be true at the same time. And that's why
Yeah.
this message of, it's not either or, you're not this or that. Our message is very much both. And I am a person that caused harm, unfortunately. I am a person who has been sexually victimized myself. I'm a lot of things, and I can I can figure out how to exist in the same space being all those things. And
Yes.
That's just something that people aren't really accustomed to, you know, knowing and believing and experiencing. And so our whole justice system is set up of you're either this or you're that. And if, you know,
you're the good guys or you're the bad guys.
Yeah. And it's like, let's build bridges, because there is a lot of what's in me and you, and there's a lot of what's in you and some of the people that, that are, you're incarcerating, you know?
So. Right.
Well, I mean, and honestly, incarcerating 10 times more people than any other country doesn't make us better. It doesn't make us safer. It means that, you know, in some rural communities, not only are there lots and lots of people incarcerated, but there are a whole bunch of just regular people who are working in that setting. That's not good for them either.
No.
No. All these people who work in those settings, that ruins them too.
I mean, the detectives, you know, you have a level of deception. You know, I was astonished, because I am naturally very honest and open, and I was astonished by how much I was lied to by the detectives. Where I'm trying to cooperate, it's like, oh, like I don't know that you are actually any better than me sitting across from me.
Well, and that must have been astonishing, having come from, you originally wanted a career in law enforcement, and that was where your mind was. And so I want to draw the connection here with what we're talking about to the whole evolution that we've come to. And so I want to make sure that everybody knows we're not actually really here to talk about WASH, although we're all on a development team, and that's a organization in development. So it doesn't officially exist yet, but it will. And it exists in our minds and our hearts and the effort that we're putting into making it be official. And so that's Women Against Sexual Harm. And so as people who have been, you know, advocating for ourselves and then learning that how worthy we are and how important it is we advocate for ourselves, and then we're advocating for our families, and then we're advocating for other persons forced to register, and then we're advocating for all the loved ones, the entire community of impacted persons by the registry. And really, we're advocating for everyone, but we haven't really put a lot of focus on that last piece. And, you know, a group of Shine Voices and the people that are Shine WASH was born out of Shine Voices and born out of a Pathfinder. We decided to collaborate a few months back and found that that was a fantastic intersection of minds and efforts and thoughts. And one of the things that we came to the conclusion, and like I said, Jackie was already there, was that we were not going to be, we don't believe that we will be victorious. So you can be successful in advocacy, but I want to win. And I think my collaborators, we want to win. And what does win mean? What does win look like? Well, win, a lot of people will tell you that means, you know, abolishing the registry. Okay, I understand that. That there's a value in that for sure, because we live under that thing, and that thing is horrible. Okay, none of us here would probably disagree that the registry is a bad thing. But are you going to win if that nice shirt, honey, nice shirt?
Why, thank you.
Yeah. That's the logo for Women Against Sexual Harm. Are you going to win? To win, we got to change the narrative. We just discussed that, right? So there's this terrible false narrative that is forced on us every day. Like Joe said, even though he knew it wasn't true, he hears it every day. So do we. So how are you going to win? How are you going to change the narrative if only us, our community, thinks that abolishing the registry or changing it, because some people believe in changing it in some way that is not so oppressive and unconstitutional, is a good thing? And are you going to win? Are you going to convince the other people, the rest of the world, right? So there's approximately 3 million of us in the United States, and that's including our loved ones. There's probably a little bit more. I don't have an exact count for you, but that's a lot of people. But there's a lot more people in the United States and the rest of the world than there are our community. So what we were thinking about is we need to evolve a little bit with what we want and how we're going to win. And if you're trying to change the narrative with the rest of the community, maybe you should start thinking about and talking about and focusing on what the rest of the community wants. What is the kind of language that they use? That's their narrative. So we have been talking about replacing this us versus them, which is really how we operate nowadays in advocacy. We're us and they're them. And we want to change their minds, the laws that they support and pass and enforce, and what the media's narrative is. We want to change them, except for I propose to you, we're never going to win unless we are them. So you have this idea that we're going to positively change the community, okay, by using our voices, and that you hear that a lot. If you have if you're touch any part of PFR advocacy, you hear that we got to use our voices. A lot of the organizations are called Voices. Our speaking group is Shine Voices. Okay, so there you go. And that is smart. Okay, we got to speak up. We got to stand up and speak out, except for you better be speaking the language of the people you want to change their mind. You better be focusing on what it is they value. Why do they consider you the other? And so we've talked about that and thought about it a lot. And it came to us all that if you listen to their narrative, it's all about the prevention of sexual harm. They consider us almost unanimously the cause of sexual harm, to the extent that they completely erase the fact that many of us are survivors of sexual harm. Most organizations that support people who are survivors of sexual harm erase us from the rolls. Throw away your survivor, or what they like to call us victims, and I won't claim victimhood. Victims are people who died, and I survived. Anyway, you throw away your victim card. You're not allowed to have even a voice or part of that narrative. Okay, but they value that. Well, don't we too? Is there anybody, seriously, I mean this dead serious, anyone on this call that doesn't value the prevention of sexual harm?
Of course we do.
To ourselves, because a lot of us were survivors of sexual harm, and to our families, probably the person that was involved in whatever happened with us, of course. And so, can't we be so much more powerful and win if we want what the community wants, because we are the community? We were just talking about our humanity. We cannot embrace an us versus them in ourselves. And I don't think we should embrace an us versus them perspective and approach with our advocacy. We can positively impact the situation with the community and the relation between the two, the us versus them, by being the community. So, I mean, so that's been the evolution of our conversation about advocacy.
And if you think about it too, it's like if you think about cancer, or poverty, these are wicked problems. These are problems that affect all of society, right? And it's very rare that you meet somebody that, has never been impacted somehow by cancer in their life. I lost my mom to cancer 4 years ago. She was only 59. This is sexual violence is a wicked problem. And it is a problem that's not going away. It's a problem that's always existed. And when, as a community, if we're not willing to have those conversations about what does this look like? What does this look like in my family unit? How do I feel about this just happened to my little sister? I automatically have a, hate response to the person that caused harm. But we're not thinking more systemically about, where is all of this coming from? And so when you realize that, this affects everybody. It's not just that person that's on the registry or that person that, was harmed in some way. It's the entire families. It's the entire workplace. I've never been in a job where I haven't been sexually harassed at work. You know,
Me
it's just,
either.
it's pervasive. And like you said, we already are the community.
Yes.
So that we can just have these candid conversations about, you know what, I'm not exactly, you know, the hard part about this type of advocacy is the assumption that we're promoting greater protection and freedoms for people who cause harm.
Right.
And that is asinine. That is actually not what we are promoting at all. We are promoting the prevention of sexual harm and violence and how to do this better, you know? And so I think that we have to talk more.
Yeah. If you want that to go away, if you want the registry and then the injustice that we live in every day to go away, you have to convince people that you care about the prevention of sexual harm, and then you have to contribute to how do we prevent it. And that's what WASH is. That is exactly what we're proposing to do, and that's why the name is Women Against Sexual Harm, because that's exactly it is going to be a forward community facing organization, which is a lot harder than preaching to the choir. And I'm not saying that preaching to the choir is a bad thing, because I've done a lot of preaching to the choir myself, and so does Joe, and so has Jackie, you know, and we have to encourage each other. We have to get together in groups and educate each other and inform each other. And all of that is really, really good. And I'm not going to stop doing it. However, if we only preach to the choir, it perpetuates that us versus them. And they will always think what Jackie just said. And they do think that. A lot of people think that we're just advocating for things to be easier for ourselves. And why would they be on board with that? Because we're still the bad guys, right? So one of the things that we feel like is really important is the value of lived experience. I think Jackie touched on that, and I think Joe did too. So that's one of the things, instead of it being this yucky, horrible thing that we try not to think about and that we had to process and work through and blah, 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 and all those things are true or have been at one point of our lives, we have to be able to see that thing that happened as actually something that we can use for good.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know something so well, in a way, if we're able to be honest with ourselves. In a way that there's so many people either are ignoring it because they don't know how to process it. There's no words for it. It's taboo. We're not allowed to talk about that. If we talk about that, there's consequences to talking about it, etc. Or they're very naive, because there's tons of naive people. I'm raising my hand. Okay. This little girl was about as naive as they got. And this essentially, that was how I got in trouble. I want to call it stupid, but I won't, because that's my little wicked narrative. I call myself stupid. I wasn't stupid, but I was very naive. And there's lots of people like that.
One of those dumb, smart people.
There you go. I was a dumb, smart person. Exactly. And it's very easy for us to remain either in that I'm ignoring that thing that I don't want to understand, I can't talk about, I can't process, because... Or be naive, as I was, because our culture and our media and our lawmakers and our law enforcers, that reinforces that false narrative keeps reinforcing over and over, over and over. This ignore it, don't look, don't talk about it, the what, you know?
And not only that, you know, our justice systems, especially like in a place like Florida, where, you know, in order to be tough on crime and combat this problem, we're going to become the bigger rapist.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea behind that is pure violence. You know, mm-hmm. So what we're proposing, this win strategy, is like almost like a quiet, subversive type of winning, where we just get people to see themselves in this situation one way or another. It doesn't have to be as radical as, like, let me tell you about the horrors of being on the registry. It
No.
can be as simple as, like, hey, you know, I was in this situation and I didn't know what to do, and it snowballed, and I had nobody to talk to. I couldn't say anything to anybody. And you just slowly start to help people understand that the narrative that's out there is not truly the narrative of what's happening in everybody's internal realities in these scenarios and situations, whether it's in church, in your workplace, in school systems, in family
Athletics.
units. It's
Yeah.
everywhere.
It's
It's
everywhere.
everywhere. And
Yeah.
so we can subvert this system by getting more people to just imagine themselves in that in those shoes, because it could be them at any moment. Either
And
way, victimize.
it can be done completely in a very honest, truthful, but appropriate way. And what we propose to do is to deliver very customized workshops for different groups and different settings, because it has to really resonate with the individual. So they will see themselves, like Jackie said, in the situation. And then when red flags are shared with them, the ones that we didn't see or we saw and ran right past them because we were doing what everybody else was doing, like this thing, well, I don't see that. They will feel that and see it and go, oh my gosh, that's me. But it has to be delivered. You cannot deliver that message in the same way to a group about sexting as you are going to about a group about that's happening in a family unit, or a group that's happening about in a workplace. Or you really have to customize. You really have, because then it's like that, it's like that video they make you watch. At work, the HR makes you watch so that you know that when you're going to get in trouble for sexual harassment. It's that video, the one that everybody laughs at. It's like, was that an episode of The Office? Okay, it can't be like that. Anyway, you're going to
Yeah.
ask that man.
Yeah, I keep thinking about I think I told you about this Elizabeth Clements, that
Yes.
RAA, and one of the things she talked about in that webinar was how often if something has happened to you as a child, and this certainly was true for me, your brain just has a way of sort of like stuffing it down and like not addressing it and just pretending it didn't happen. And often then when you grow up, you're an adult, you're out in the world doing stuff, when you see just the little hints, the little edges of something that reminds your brain of what happened to you when you were a kid, your brain won't address it. Your brain just says, oh, can't look at that because that's big and scary, and it prevents you from being it makes you be a bystander who doesn't say anything when you see the shadows of something that you were that reminds you of your own abuse. And I had never thought about that or considered that, and damn, if that's true, that explains a lot about why we can't fix this problem.
Right.
Why if interfamilial sexual abuse just generation after generation just continues. If we never really heal from the trauma, in my family, when people in my family and I had a grandpa who was like kind of understood to be like, don't leave your kids with grandpa. I had a great uncle who everybody sort of understood, don't leave your kids with that guy. And when one of my cousins, as an adult, came out and said she was remembering some things that had happened to her as a child, my mom's reaction was, oh, that happens to everybody. Get over it. Like, people don't get over it. It's not a thing that you just like stuff down and then all of a sudden you're healed. You either stuff it down and are a shitty help to the next generation because you never healed from your own trauma, or you do something shitty. You become a bad guy when you're a grown up
Yeah,
because that's how you.
you revisit the trauma on somebody else, and because your body never forgets that stuff. And if that's how sometimes people who are very young, very, very young, don't remember the trauma, end up, making and doing an offense because they are just reliving what happened to them and no other way to process it. Because when you're that young, there is no way to process it unless somebody knows it happened and they work you through the process. And a lot of times that isn't the case.
Yeah, even if they don't remember exactly what happened to them, what's stored in there is that shame. in the complexity of these, you know, circumstances, especially when you have family members that are trying to protect other family members and don't speak up and don't defend and have responses like that of, well, this just happens to everybody, or, you know, what was I going to do? Send your father to prison? You know,
right.
Those kind of conversations that type of shame that a child carries on, whether they remember the situations fully or not, that's going to play out in their whole life.
Yep. It
is interesting. The my polygrapher I've had for the last couple of years now, it took me a while to get to have a good relationship with having to do annual polygraphs. And this gentleman, he wants to personally start collecting data for his own polygraphy practice, because he has seen so many recurring themes, and this being one of the most major ones, is that, you know, most people have some type of traumatic childhood experience that's sexual in nature. And then, you know, he's collecting the data unofficially, but there's tons of perspective out there that if we could just talk about it.
Yes. And I want to add one more thing, and then Joe's got, I'm certain, some really important things to add to this conversation. The thing that I wanted to add is, and this is something that is will be a focus for us with WASH, is the whole premise that we're not allowed to get help, because I think sometimes people realize they're actually being real honest with themselves, and it's pretty obvious to them that they are close to making a wrong decision, or they're having you know, unhealthy thoughts, and or they're pushing boundaries, and they know it, but they really don't know what to do about it, because it's very overwhelming to them. And so they would very much like to get help. And I know this is a circumstance quite frequently, because when I was in group for a long time, I was in group with men for many years. And, you know, they would discuss this. They would say, well, Jews would say, look, I knew I was having these bad thoughts, but I didn't, what, because I couldn't know what to do about it. I didn't know who I was allowed to speak to, and so that it could prevent it. Of course, they wanted to not get in trouble. They didn't want to do those things. They knew they were very uncomfortable with them. And some of the gentlemen were actually in my group because they went to someone and said, please help me. I don't want to do this. I'm being overwhelmed with very, very unhealthy thoughts and urges to do things, but that I really don't want to do, because I know they're not good and they're going to harm somebody. But when they went to those persons and reported that, they were told, oh yeah, we're going to get you the help, buddy. And then they were summarily arrested. That can't be either. So if we're going to, by, you know, giving workshops that are informed by our lived experiences, and we all have different lived experiences. What we have learned is we're all very unique, and what happened to each of us is not exactly the same as that happened to the next person. And we have a real understanding of that, but we also understand that there are patterns and trends. But if we're going to do this and we expect people to embrace it, and they do, and they see these themselves in some of these scenarios that are presented, and then we are not advocating for them to be able to get help, what have we done for them? Maybe they're going to be able to stop it themselves. Maybe they're going to make the right judgments and, you know, leave that job or whatever. Or maybe they're not, because they're still very overwhelmed. And what do they do about it? You know, it's one thing to know, and it's another thing to know what to do about it. So I think that's going to be really important. But I wanted hopefully Joe to talk about, you can talk about whatever you want, Joe, man, because you've got plenty of good things to say. But what we haven't talked about, and I think that you know the most about, is being able to share this. You know, our idea isn't just to share this with persons out in the community who have not already had some sort of trouble or gotten into trouble. We want to be sure this message is actually for everyone, because it's about everyone. This is a human condition. And so, you know, Joe already works a lot in the incarceral setting and with folks that are coming out in reentry and the court mandated treatment. And so I wanted him to talk about how will be something that we're carrying to them, and how he envisions that happening.
Oh,
he's muted.
How come he keeps remuting him?
I don't know.
I don't understand that.
I think that, like, the whole concept beyond us being, like, totally universal, with, like, looking like one another. It's not just one specific person. It's looks that you would never expect. So I think that that's like the most important thing, is to have people, like, it's a total empathy movement. We're just trying to make people be able to understand one another's pain. It's not just like our plight, their plight. It's everyone's plight. It's something that, like, we need to be more honest about, because this is a universal problem. So that's why you have to have different faces and different backgrounds to go to different places to advocate and really educate people. Like, there is a whole niche of football players that are in jeopardy every night in college. No one is speaking to them about the registry. There's no one that's telling these guys, none of their football coaches from Clemson, South Carolina, Arkansas, none of the big schools are telling them about, yo, how close you are to ending up on the registry. So if they have a person like myself that can speak in X's and O's, and a friend of mine, Anthony, who's running a thing called Life After the Lights, he's also another person forced to register that played college football, a Division I program, that needs to let guys know how he landed on the registry. And it's literally something that these guys will be able to hear. But if we don't have people like myself and Anthony, we can't speak to these people. So it's all about, like, forming teams of universality. Like, we have to come from all walks, all backgrounds. You know, most importantly, I feel like this has to be led by who it's being led by right now. Like, that's why I'm behind WASH. I'm not a woman, but I'm behind this totally, because it's happening to my sisters. It's happening to me. It's happening to people's mothers. It's happening to people's grandmothers. Like, watching Tammy's story on YouTube, there's no horror on YouTube that's like that. That's a real person. Like, and if you didn't know Tammy's story, you wouldn't think that she was on that. So that's why it's important to have different faces with different stories telling their lived experience, because this is what happened to me. Did this happen to you? Let's be honest about things. We need to start addressing the pink elephant in the room. That's why we include the pink elephant with everything that we do, because I'm tired of not addressing the pink elephant that's in the room. That's what's going to keep us stuck. I don't want to be chained to the past anymore. We'll be stuck if we don't have anything to say. So it's all about getting it out in a way that we have yet to do. Now, I'm not saying that we haven't done this in this format, but this is a new day and age. We're not using social media properly. Like, there's a whole group of people on TikTok that are just starting to listen to me right now. We as a unit, everybody who's fighting in this realm in advocacy, we are not using social media properly, because most of us aren't allowed on it. But that's not to say for those of us who are allowed on it, we're not utilizing our platform properly. Universality is the key. And we need to start building more bridges with more organizations that are outside of our plight, but are empathetic enough to understand our plight. But you have to have the right faces build these bridges to these people. You can't have certain individuals in certain places in power. You can't have the punter playing center unless this guy's a Ray Guy type of dude. You got to have people in the right position. And if we don't have people in the right positions, you will get your ass kicked.
Well,
in any sport.
That's the truth. And we need to be a team. And what I also totally agree with is that everybody, the whole idea of inclusivity, that nobody should be left out. And that is exactly the reason why I started Shine. The it's a Sisters Healing Injustice Networking for Empowerment. And why? Because women forced to register were left out. We were invisible. People would tell me straight to my face many times, "You're insignificant." That was the word, over and over. Which essentially means you don't count. Okay. So, and I was told that, many other women were told that, we were treated like we don't count. And for some of us, okay, maybe we didn't believe we counted with that little wicked inner narrative, but quite frankly, for some of us, that was new news. I will tell you, I hadn't been told I didn't count. Now, I've been treated like a woman, and women are treated differently, and everybody knows that. I don't care what woman you are, how high up and what hierarchy you are in. God bless you, men. I love you all. But in the greater scheme of things, women are not treated as well as they ought to be. So I knew all about that. But quite frankly, I had never had anybody tell me to my little skinny white butt face, "You insignificant." Really? I mean, I remember the first time somebody said it to me, I wanted to punch them. I thought, "Who the hell are you? Oh, how dare you talk to me like that?" I was all, thinking that I was special or something, but nobody's insignificant. I thought to myself, "Who, you can't talk to me like that because you can't talk to anybody like that." And it was, I was told that by law enforcement, attorneys, therapists, forensic psychiatrists, you name it. Everybody.
And part of the issue too is that, everyone else gets to tell our story for us. Yeah, I
Yes.
was shocked when the next day I read the what was published on the news and on Google, and I was like, where did that even come from? That is so far from the truth. We might have a justice system that is, innocent and proving until proven guilty, but when you have a arrest report that's not accurate, and everybody's rushing towards plea deals, you never get a chance to set a record straight, and then you have to spend the rest of your life trying to overcome this false narrative that's out there. And it's like, really, you're scared of me? Like, really, you want to kill me? Like, how about you sit down and get to know me for a second? Don't believe everything you read online, right? So we're not only just completely ignored or minimized, but we're also
Villainized.
villainized
And
and
what a paradox. So once you go into the system, you're told you're nothing, you're not significant, there's not enough of you or whatever. And really, that was a good experience for me. That was a really good thing. I hated hearing that. I didn't believe it. I was like, Joe. One thing I did know about myself is, okay, yeah, you're not going to tell me that. I have significance. There may be things about myself that I don't care for, and I pick on them all the time, and I'm putting myself down. And I've allowed other people to do that too, except for you don't tell me I'm in. But it was transformative when I heard that over and over, because in my mind I said, you will not call any of us that because we are significant. Every single one of us. And then it kind of led me on this evolution of noticing who was also being treated insignificant, who was left out, who was marginalized, who nobody cares about what they have to say. And that carries right into advocacy. And I noticed it really clearly the very first conference I went to. I had already been noticing it, but of course, I guess I thought I was going to go to some sort of PFR Nirvana. Okay, that doesn't exist. All right, and I love conferencing, and I love meeting other advocates, and it's the best thing. And if you've never done it, please do it if you can. Okay, so don't get me wrong, but one thing I noticed right away that a whole bunch of people were being treated like they were insignificant because they weren't even there. And the time that I noticed this, I was the only woman forced to register at the conference, that particular one. So, and that was interesting. So it really informed me as of how important, like Joe said, this has to be delivered by all people to all people in a way that they will be able to embrace it, that it resonates for them in their life experience, and it needs to be for everyone. So we also leave out the incarcerated person a lot, and I've actually heard this spoken by the most well-meaning and highly reputable advocates. Well, we're not advocating for them. Really? Do they know that? I've asked people that before. Do they know that? Because I think if they knew that, you would have a serious problem because they think you're advocating for them. I'm not going to tell them that what you just said because that's not helpful. We don't win when we're only advocating for this group over here. And I only learned that because I wasn't part of this group over here. And I decided that that wasn't okay with me. And when something's not okay with me, I have to decide what I'm going to do about it. Every one of us needs to decide what we're going to do about it. So we believe in person forced to register led, person forced to register advocacy. We believe that every impacted person is as much of the community as every person who isn't impacted because they just are and they don't know it. And we believe it's everybody, and that we should be forming communication workshops for every person in the way that they can understand them. And that is a huge undertaking. So if anybody's listening and they're thinking, oh my gosh, that's a great idea, I sure would like to help with that, please leave your name and contact information with Anne. or if not, I hope that it is, you know, it's changed your thinking maybe. Maybe it's given you something to think about. You know, what do you think? Joe? I feel like leaving the incarcerated person out, or the person who's in reentry, he's on mute again, who's just coming back, or the person who's in court mandated treatment. I think that's a huge mistake, but it happens all the time.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like, it would be like having a conversation, like nine men having a conversation about a woman having a baby and excluding the woman that's in the room. Like, none of us know what the hell we're talking about. We've never experienced it. So how are we all sitting at the table conversing about something we've never experienced? It's the equivalent. If you leave out the person who's been in prison, but you're talking about the prison experience and you've never missed commissary, or you never put on the boots, or you've never been on lockdown when you were supposed to have a visit and went through any of that type of weird drama and trauma inside of yourself. If you've never went through that, how are you sitting at the table without us? All you need is like one of us. That's about it. One. You don't need to add like 1,000 of us if you're that afraid. Like, just a little bit of pepper is okay.
Yeah. Yes.
So much. There's bigger conversations about, you know, putting traumatized people in traumatized environments, you know, and advocating for sexual violence within prison systems. You know.
Yeah.
As this population exactly. is targeted way more, so there's a lot. There's a lot going on.
There's that sexual harm happens in the incarceral setting, and also, you know, I hear all the time that people are very interested in reentry, which is good, okay, particularly for our population, because a lot of what is offered for reentry is not even applicable or helpful to our population. So we really, really, really need to focus on that, except for what is focused on, except for from Joe. Thank you, not your average Joe, but the standard is, let's, you know, show you a place to live, get you a job at a second chance employer. Let's make sure that you have some work boots and you have a place to get four squares. And those are all good things, right? We need clothes. Yeah. We need a job, because our probation officer says, well, you better work or we're going to violate you. We need a place to lay our heads, because you better have an address or we're going to violate you. I got all of that check, check, and check, except for, we're leaving out the most important thing you need for reentry, which is what Joe offers and what we intend to incorporate with what we're doing, which is, what the hell just happened to me?
Yeah.
And how do I process that and become this person who's a law-abiding person who lives on the outside and has a productive life and lives their best life and loves themselves? That's a lot. But that's not really provided. Not on any kind of, you know, grand scale at all. There are some people, Joe, that are doing it, but most are not. They're really focusing on the boots and a meal and a place to live, all important. But honestly, you can have all that and not have the thing that Joe gives, or the thing that we will incorporate into our workshops for that population, and really, really be lacking.
Well-being is so crucial and critical. If you can help somebody develop their personal well-being, then the restrictions, the rules, the policies become more bearable. It impacts you less when you have social capital that you're building, when you're believing that you can still develop a good life for yourself, and those types of personal well-being is last on the list for, you know, yes. everybody just trying to survive.
Yes.
Yep. And that's why, that is exactly why that it's very important to have, like what Joe is saying, everybody needs to be included. You know, we're building teams right now. We're building our organization, but one of the things we're doing is we're figuring out how we're building teams to inform these lived experience workshops. It will not just be the people on the WASH development team, because that's just a few people, right?
And that's so empowering. You know, when Dr. Mitchell reached out to me to collaborate, to actually do research and write and publish with her, and nothing about my rules changed, but my whole well-being, you know, my living, my everyday life improved drastically just by being offered a seat at the table. Just, and at first I thought it was just, do you want to hear my stories? And it became, oh, you can actually write. You can actually use the skills that you have. And I think the more that we get people just doing what they do well already and give them space and give them a seat at the table, whatever table that is, just pull up a chair.
Yes.
It just increases so much for personal resilience.
Yes. And that's exactly what we're talking about. That's the evolution that we've come to. And this is the I think the critical piece, which is it is an evolution. I will tell you, this is not something I was thinking about in this way 8 years ago. I wasn't there yet. But I will tell you that when I had my epiphany and I started allowing myself to be on that journey, because for many years I wasn't allowing myself to be on any journey except for a journey to misery. I had that epiphany and I was like, okay, I'm going to allow myself to put my first foot on the yellow brick road. Okay. And that's when the evolution began. And that's when I started to like think about myself in a different way and put things together and do something positive with what happened in my life that was not positive.
Right.
No matter how you looked at it, that was a very negative thing that happened in my life. But when I finally gave myself permission to make something good out of that, then the evolution began. And it's still moving. But we are in a space now that we want to be able to share that with others, so that if you decide that that's the path you want to get on, you want to be on that journey, that your mind gets open to it now that you've heard about it. It may take you years to figure out. I hope you do it tomorrow, though. But it took me 8.5 years. I'm a slow, slow learner. So don't kick yourself.
Give yourself some credit. Like they put so many obstacles in front of you that the fact that anybody on the registry finds their way to helping others and advocacy, like give yourself pats on the back for that, because, you know, it's they put up all the restrictions to make your lives difficult. And it's
true.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you for
saying that. Like, you know, like sometimes we need to hear that. We don't do that enough to one another. Like, yo, give yourself some credit for what you endured. You know, every day there's a Damocletian sword that's hanging over your head. Like, give yourself some credit that you didn't chop your own head off because of what is hanging over it. Like, afford yourself grace daily, regardless of what is hanging over your head.
100%.
It's the way to get through this. Like, I had ample time to sit in a cell. I did 14 years, so I had a lot of time to sit and analyze. Like, this isn't brand new, even though I'm newly released. This isn't brand new. Like, I had a lot of time to sit in front of a mirror and go back and forth in my head, including 422 days when it was COVID, when we only had 15 minutes out of the cell every day. So I definitely had a lot of time for self-reflection, you know, and that is the key to every day living that way of affording yourself grace by waking up and saying, you know what, it's another day. Regardless of how BS it seems, something is going to come from this. If you keep telling yourself that, you will program yourself to live like that. And it makes it a little bit more manageable. Right now, I'm kind of living in a hell scenario. My children were just dropped back off into my life after years. Their mother was incarcerated. So right now, my life is kind of weirdly in shambles. But at the same time, I know that getting on this and being around people like you guys and talking about advocating in the proper way, it doesn't seem like hell right now. So sometimes we just need to hear from people like you, Anne, to say, give yourself a pat on the back. Thanks. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I talk to a lot of people impacted by the registry, and it is a very small number of those people who find their way to anything like what you guys do. I mean, you guys are like mind-blowingly, you know, and I know there are other, you know, you meet other people who are advocates. But for every person that's an advocate, there's a ton of people who are just barely paying the bills and
I
just
talk about this a lot.
barely.
There's this personal pendulum swing that you go through where, sometimes you're so angry that you want to change things and get involved. And then the other half of the time, you just want to go live in the woods and disconnect from everyone. Just be left alone, let me live my life. I won't bother nobody. It's
Well,
weird.
people do that. Well, I live in the woods, but anyway, I need all of the support and encouragement and light that anybody wants to give me, and I very much appreciate it from you because you are a very discerning person. Sometimes you just say stuff, but you don't. You really mean it, and you know what you're talking about. And I need that. Like, we all need that. I think sometimes, and I actually hate this because I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it elevates anybody. Sometimes, we'll come on and talk or we'll do something, and people think, well, that they can do that because somehow we're special or superheroes. We're not. I don't want anybody to think that. We, all three of us, and we know each other, we have our moments, our issues, our vulnerabilities, our challenges, our problems, man. And I want people to know that so that we're with you. That's the most important thing. That's why these sorts of things have to be PFR led for PFR and PFRs impacted. Okay. They just have to be because we really know it's in our hearts. Who forgets? Who forgets that shit? Who forgets 14 years of incarceration and how that felt? Nobody ever forgets it. You're making something good out of it, but you didn't forget it.
No.
It's still there. I remember 8.5 years wrapped up in a blanket on my sofa by the front door because I was terrified somebody was going to bust into my house all the time. I could, trembling, trembling. Nobody.
That's worse than prison to me, Dano.
It was my own prison I made for myself,
Yes.
and I was in.
Yes.
I lived in abject terror.
Yeah.
I would do what I had to do and be, because I feel like when you're a mama and a woman, you know how to pull it out of your ass when you have to. And I did that
Yeah.
for the people I needed to. And I did what I had to do. But when I wasn't having to do that, which was a lot of my time, I spent that time in abject terror. I had to go out of the house. I was terrified. If I had to do anything, I was terrified. And I literally, they call it, my son called it affectionately the burrito blanket because he would, Mama, you wrapped
Yeah, you got
yourself
your
up like
burrito?
a burrito. He saw me enough times.
And that's why they've been winning. And that's why, if we can offer that type of well-being and mindset shifting for people to set themselves free mentally first, then they're on a track to where whatever they have to face, whatever the rules are, they're going to be able to do it, and they're going to be able to do it with a lot more courage. It just takes time.
And people living their best life are not people who are offending. I tell people all the time, I want you to live your best life
That's right.
because that's a person who has healthy boundaries and who is living a positive, productive life in the community. Okay. That is your best life. That is prevention. That is what we are all about. That's
And
what I
nothing
want.
about the registry, nothing about the registry makes that easy for anyone. You
It
know,
doesn't promote it.
make people feel hateful, mean thoughts about the people around them. That doesn't make anyone do better or be better or
At
feel better.
all.
Doesn't make them reoffend less often. They talked about how, so I can't remember where this was, maybe that same Restorative Action Alliance webinar, about how in the Native American community, they can choose not to send their people to our shitty prisons and they can just choose to manage it themselves. And one of the things she talked about was when somebody, somebody has offended or done something they're not supposed to, that the whole community, smiles at them on the highway and, yells out, "Hi, so and so," as they're walking, and they give these people roles within their community, like go visit the shut-ins. Shut-ins are desperate for they need someone to talk to, and people on the registry need someone to talk to, and why not find a way to like help both people at the same time?
Yes, it's restorative.
Give them something to live for, you know?
We separate everybody into their categories, and then we want to memorialize them so that they can never be anything but that. And one of the things that, you know, Megan and I in our research were promoting is this model, this COSA model, which very much came out of communities like that. It's care, it's circles of support and accountability, you know, where you help people transition, and, you know, you have a team of volunteers and you have a team of practitioners, and you literally create a support network from the time that they are being, like, before they're even released to transitioning into the community, and you immediately start building community and connection between people that are just regular volunteers in the community that have no real association to that person. And they can take the most violent offender, or at least with those labels, regardless of what had happened in the past, and they can huddle around somebody. And I think there's just so much to be said for restorative justice practices that we might not be able to change policy overnight, but it doesn't necessarily cost a whole lot to be able to implement stuff like that. It just takes partnership, and it just takes people being willing to build bridges. Vermont is the state that started this in this country that has been doing this for over 20 years, and other states have joined in as well. And so much so that Vermont DOC actually funds community justice centers to implement programs like this and to do trainings like this. And it's like, wow, imagine if the funding that is going towards keeping the registries alive and well actually went towards restorative justice practices, you know, build
be
these
amazing. Well, and maybe, and also to prevention, real prevention, you know,
if it all comes down to money as a bottom line, like the data is there. And that's what's most frustrating about our particular issue, because it's so fear-based, and it's mania fear-based, that the empirical data that shows, you know, these laws are ineffective, or at least they're not having the intended, you know, effect that you wanted. We have years of data now. And if it comes down to a bottom line of money, we can show that when you implement programs like that, recidivism goes down. You know, you're actually saving money for your state, for your programs.
But we haven't been able to convince them with that narrative, even though it is 1000% true.
Well, probably because, you know, the private prisons have, you know, if you just follow the money, you think about all the people who are making money off of the fake therapy, all the people who are making money off of the ankle monitors, all the people who are making money off of polygraphs, all the people who are making money off of just the prisons themselves.
So all the people making the money off of the lie, and how do you combat that? Well, you present the truth. It's not easy. I don't expect it to be easy. I have never been a part of a forward-facing a community-based organization that's going to be talking about this topic. I expect it to be very difficult, except for if we're the only people that really know the truth because we've lived it, and they're not going to listen to any of the data, even their own data, which is interesting to me. And they're not going to listen to, you know, look at their research, the statistics. They don't. We know this because we know what it is. And this is part of our preaching to the choir. We all get together and we read it and we listen to awesome people who are gathering it and researching it. And it's fabulous. And I feel great about it. And then when you try to share that with anybody, they're like, yeah, but that one child. And this is the only reason why we've come to the conclusion. Okay, we start there.
Mm-hmm.
You value prevention of sexual harm. Okay, well, I have a child too.
That's right.
So do I. And the women could come to that conclusion very quickly. Not that everybody else on this call doesn't have people in their lives that they really care about and don't want hurt, obviously, including ourselves. But many of our women are either bearing a child or just bore a child or have a young child or have grandchildren that they're caring for, like Tammy. It's so close to us. And of course, we want to prevent harm, sexual harm or any harm, but sexual harm for that child. So we're talking the same language. And we just firm believe that that's the way that we're going to win. If we get the door open by speaking their language, valuing what, because we are them.
Yeah, how do you dismantle a stigma as strong as this one? It's going to take a lot of creativity for sure.
It's to show them exactly that they have the same stigma because it's a human problem, that they're a human being too, and they're just that's why our tagline, and I probably shouldn't tell you this because it's coming up, but the tagline, we're going to be doing a presentation, and it is 2 degrees of separation, the danger we all face. Nobody in the world, no human being is more than 2 degrees separated from this particular kind of harm, this danger. Everybody, most people, I would say, 90%, including myself, and I know Jackie thought the same thing, thought they were at least 100 degrees from this kind of harm, particularly perpetrating it. But we all in our minds, because maybe it's the way we protect ourselves, it's definitely the narrative we hear everywhere. I would never do that. I that's those people.
You should have known better.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes right back to that us versus them, and we're believing the narrative. And so we all think we're 100 degrees away from this happening, but we propose to you that nobody's more than 2 degrees away from it. And some of us are so close, they're so close, they're falling off the cliff, and they just don't even know it. And that's where we have to enter in with the conversation about the truth.
Yeah, I feel like I came to this advocacy so many different ways. I was a victim myself. My daughter could easily have been put on the registry. My other daughter, she's getting married this fall, and the father-in-law is currently incarcerated. My partner's on the registry. Like it's everywhere. It's just everywhere.
Yeah,
And people don't get
that's what
that
makes it
until,
unique, right? Someone like you have different hats that you wear, and you can come at this from different perspectives. So depending on who you speak to, you can either speak to, as
as
a
a
partner,
mother,
as a mother,
as a
right?
partner, as a
Exactly.
survivor.
And that's more common, and that's what people don't realize. This is why I try to draw that comparison with cancer, because it's so common that, how you relate to this particular issue, you might only see it as one thing, but then when you start seeing sort of adjacent perspectives, you realize like, oh, I actually do have some feelings about this. I actually do have a little bit of experience with that, and that is uncomfortable. And what does that bring up for me? Yeah.
And what do I do about it? And that's why that has to be a part of our conversation. We can't just bring workshops to people so that they can see themselves in those situations and go, oh my gosh, that's me. And wow, I wasn't really recognizing all those red flags, but I see them now. They're all around me. But we also have to be able to advocate for people to be able to take some action, to be able to do something about that. And at this time, I don't really feel like that's an option for most people. There
There's
are
no
real,
consequences.
yes, there's just consequences, no option. I remember that for myself. I was flailing about trying to get help because I clearly something horrible was happening, but I didn't know how to make it stop. I didn't know what to do about it. And that was, there were no good options.
There
So
aren't.
there was zero good options. I actually reported myself. And people ask me sometimes,
I
regret
had a
that?
guy I
Like,
was trying to talk
no.
into coming, trying to come on, talking to coming on the reg, coming on the war room and talking, and still hemming and hawing about that. But before he got arrested, he reached out to a whole bunch of places trying to find help. He'd been abused as a child and kind of stuffed it down and forgot all about it for a while, and then it eventually kind of boiled back up, and he was starting to, head down the path of causing harm. And he tried and tried and tried to find help. He couldn't afford it. There was no such thing, or the very few places were like outrageous amounts of money, and they would only treat you for like a month for that outrageous amount of money. And he's like, I needed a lot of help. I could never have afforded that help. The only place that I could eventually get help was in prison. And
It shouldn't be like
that's a
that.
mess.
Yeah, that's another one of our focuses, and it definitely has to go hand in hand. They're parallel. But I think once you can get people to see themselves in these circumstances, because you have described something that is essentially them, that's why they are customized. There'll be no numerous workshops customized that they will also think, oh, wow, yes, great idea. We need to be able to get help. I mean, I think in that way you will help evolve their thinking about now they're like, well, you should all go to prison. And when they realize it's themselves, I think people will have a different idea about that. I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah.
We've been
All
doing
right.
a lot of talking. You should open for everybody. Anybody who wants to talk, I'm done. I'm played.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time.
I
So
know.
there's a lot of stuff in this chat. Holy mackerel. Jim S is asking Jim Z for attorneys. Virginia is posting about a law in, I think, Florida, SB 168. I'd be curious to hear what that one is about. Someone's talking about the Tristan Act. There's like a whole nother day's worth of things to look up over there.
Did you put your book in the chat, Jackie? Because I saw somebody asked about it in the chat.
I found her book. I found her. My library has her book. I'm
You
super
should put it in
excited.
the chat.
I will put that in the chat right now. So there's Jackie's book. That is Jackie's book.
Virginia's got some comments on autism spectrum.
Oh yeah, there's others.
It's really interesting how many people aren't diagnosed until after they're arrested, and that's becoming more and more of a reality. And there's not really any accommodations. That doesn't really get factored into sentencing. Certainly doesn't get factored into the prison conditions to accommodate those types of things. But I have noticed that is a big theme for individuals with sex offenses, that they get diagnosed after the fact. Me, I was diagnosed with ADHD afterwards.
Oh yeah, I know so many people who got their diagnoses after getting into trouble, and it's heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. And I see Galen was on the call. I liked his comment, all crime is wrong, question mark. I think most scholars would disagree with you. Much of what we call crime is merely designed to control people, certain types of people. Absolutely. But we're dealing with the community's narrative, and that's where we're starting, is from their narrative, the whole us versus them, and we're going to essentially show them it's everybody. It's not us versus them. We're all us. Now there's no them. But I agree with his perspective, with some caveats. So I do have a personal thing about, I don't really think that we need a lot or any serial killers out running, wreaking havoc, or not being contained, because that is majorly dangerous to everyone, including to themselves. They often kill themselves. But that's a really small, crazy
Such a
small percentage,
small, yes,
very
such a
small
small percent.
percentage of persons that commit a crime, and it's extreme. And I think that extremity and that smallness, we could all pretty much agree on that one. But in general, he's right. He's right. But that is the community narrative that we have to deal with. They like things black, white, us versus them, very simplified. And we all know, if we live in the human life, that life isn't really like that. Life is much more complicated than that.
All right, Larry has his hand up, and apparently I can't unmute you. You got to unmute
You
yourself.
go.
There we go.
Okay. I did the unmute. Hope you all can hear me. And great. So far, love the cover on that book with the head coming out as a tree and colors on each side. That's really, really unique.
Thank you.
What I wanted to really say is that the therapy is hard to deal with, because especially for grants and things like that, anything to do with Department of Justice, on that part of the tree, there's really there's not a whole lot they can do, because sexual addiction or crimes that are related to sexual deviancy are not in the DMSR or they're not considered. Yeah, they're not considered an addiction. They're not. So therefore, it's not a medical condition.
Yeah. Larry, were you on a few war rooms ago when? Look in the chat. Look in. I'm gonna email you, because a guy came on. Basically, it was the guy from.
Was it Mike? The guy that talks with the deep voice, or was it, what was it?
It was Ira Jean Katz.
Oh,
Ira Jean Katz came on the war room just a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, why isn't this in the DSM? You know, why can't we treat this as an addiction just like we treat gambling or.
And gambling isn't either, but the DSM-5, the new one, does include gambling, and I'm not sure if they included, you know, other addictions. But
it was a really good war room, and I'm going to put a link to it in the chat if I can find it.
Yeah, Ira's right, spot on. He's been doing a lot of advocacy on the legislative branch. He believes that, you know, it's just like MOAFR, you know, Vicky's group, they've raised $45,000 for lobbyists. So.
Oh, and that lobbyist is rocketed. He's making really good progress. They have two.
Yes.
They're doing really good work.
Yeah. And I do a website for her, but in case somebody else needs help with websites, but I'll leave it at that. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I was abused as a child. And so I started looking at pictures online. I didn't know anything, but I did EMDR. It's an eye movement.
Galen has a good point there.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible idea. We'll get everybody sent to shadow prisons.
Yep.
I just wish that they could have the same empathy for people who have one addiction over another addiction. You know, somehow we're allowed to, you know, we're allowed to have empathy in our brains for alcoholics. We're allowed to have empathy in our brains for, you know, people with other addictions, but we're not allowed to have empathy if it has anything to do with sex.
No,
you can't be empathetic.
Well, and we can have empathy for people who had to do horrific things in wars, which is good, right? Because that wrecks people. It wrecks their spirit. They have to go and do things that they would never do, but they're horrific things. And we have understanding for that, and we have empathy for that. And we hope for them to go through specific kinds of therapies and treatments so that they can regain some of that. But I don't know how that is worse or better than what happens to us. I mean, they're different, but why is one, you know, demonized and villainized and cast in such a way that there's no coming back, which is ridiculous.
Sex exceptionalism.
Yes. And the other is not, right?
Yeah.
One of our co-presenters recently down at the Florida Reentry Network conference, she was a social worker for the VA, and she reported that veterans are 30, it's 35% that get convicted of sex crimes, which is well beyond any other crime for veterans. So there's a correlation there between PTSD and how people cope and how they self-soothe with sex addictions and how that can lead down to certain paths. So,
well, and that's exactly why some of the folks, so I have some friends who are in veterans PFR advocacy, and we will definitely be reaching out to them for some lived experience to inform certain workshops that are for that exact group, that population who've gone through those experiences. Because of what Jackie said, that there is a lot of different, like I said, people, everybody's experience is very unique, and we're all branded with the stereotypical, okay, this is who you are, which of course we know is ridiculous, which is we're either all driving white vans cruising around the neighborhood, we're all ready to jump out and grab somebody, or we're hiding in the bushes or whatever. But there's like these three tropes and everybody's supposed to.
I made it a point to buy a bright copper van and it was ridiculous. I thought if I'm going to live up to the stereotype, I'm going to do it my way.
Right on, baby. But we know that it's every situation is very unique, but we also know they fall into these patterns like this, what happens yeah. with veterans. And that's why it's very important that we're not going to have one very generic, you know, workshop that we make and we send that. That's ridiculous because it will not resonate with anybody.
Yep.
It'll be the laughable.
Yep. One size fits all therapy.
What we got. Yes. Yes. Oh yeah. But yeah. Don't get me started on that.
All right. Well, we're 10 minutes over. I appreciate everyone's being here and what a great conversation. Raise your hand if you're going to be at the NARSOL conference this fall. I'm excited to see a lot of my people there. So they just announced that date, October 17 to 19. And I'm so glad that it's not just regular canceled because I love my people and I want to go see them.
Very happy.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you everybody for coming. 2 weeks from now, I got a lady. She's from a group called Three Daughters and 1,000 Sons. And I think she said that she helps people. I can't remember the word for like exoneration in Missouri. Anyways, it sounds like a really fascinating. Quick last question, John.
Save chat.
Oh, yeah. So to save the chat, you're going to go into the chat. There's the three dots at the top. I'm going to click on save chat. And that way all the stuff in here, the attorney things and all the books that people are recommending, you'll have all of those after you close this chat. Love you all. Thank you for so coming.
Thank you for having us. Thank you that we can have a conversation with everybody. Thank you.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.